academic argument made a few years ago by Richard Gombrich, who's one of the leading, as a Bowdoin Chair of Sanskrit in Oxford, and leading Indological scholar. And he put forward this argument, which is basically exactly that, which is that in early Buddhist texts you can get there are indications that the four Brahmiharas was just enough, and that you could realize full liberation through practicing just the four Brahmaviharas. So that was kind of, you know, he put forward that argument, but not particularly convincing one to me anyway. But he was essentially talking about a couple of sutta passages where the Buddha was teaching to Brahmins, and of course the normal understanding is, well, he adapts his teaching to his audience, and of course there are countless other suttas where he talks about how important it is to develop insight and dependent origination and five khandhas and all of these kinds of things. So I don't really think he was meaning to say you can, you know, just not do those things. But Gombrich seemed to think that it was interesting. His perspective on it, I found, was interesting, because he's not exactly a Buddhist, although he's certainly very Buddhist friendly. He's not a sort of skeptical deconstructionist scholar. He wants to get to what he believes is the heart of the Buddha's original teachings. But he's basically from a Christian background. So he felt that if you could kind of reveal this idea that the Buddha said that through love alone you can reach salvation, that this would be something which the Buddhist community would be really excited about, or should be really excited about. And he was a bit disappointed that most Buddhists went, oh yeah, whatever. But if they ever heard of it. But to me, it's on the contrary, it's actually a very extremely important part of Buddhist self-definition and self-identity, that Buddhists believe that it's actually through wisdom, that wisdom is a higher faculty than love in spiritual development. And this is, I think, one of the ways in which I believe, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, that most Buddhists feel about the way that we practice Buddhism. So I think the point is the point you're getting at is, like, say from a scientific point of view, you can have an understanding of things.
Yeah, because knowledge is different.
Yeah. This was one of the points, I was at this conference today on religion in education, and this was one of the points that was raised, is that, of course, the you know, most terrific example from Nazi Germany, where you had all of these extremely highly educated and intelligent engineers designing death camps, and psychologists, and all of the nurses and people who were all had a lot of knowledge and were very skilled at what they did, and they participated in all terrible things. And of course, not just in Nazi Germany, it's still happening today with all the scientists who are involved in defense research and all of these kinds of things. So the answer from a Buddhist point of view is that yes, the structure of wisdom has an implicit value in it. It's not a value-free thing, and that's why the wisdom itself emerges from, classically, from sila samadhi, from ethics and meditative wholeness. Yeah. So. Yeah, wisdom isn't just... Yes, wisdom is inquiry and all of those kind of things is what contributes to wisdom, but this doesn't happen in isolation from a broader sense of development, which is why, again, to come back to that compassion and wisdom thing, is that these things have to come together. And wisdom, if it's developed without compassion, it can be extremely dangerous, yeah? Because it's very powerful. But I mean, the point you make is true, is that the wisdom and compassion always should be developed together. So in one sense, it's kind of arbitrary and a bit silly to try to say one is better than the other or something like that. But nevertheless, in most of the ways that the path is formulated, the wisdom factor is kind of a more advanced or more developed factor than this wisdom specifically, which leads directly to liberation. Whereas compassion and loving kindness and so on don't necessarily lead to liberation. You know, they certainly lead to a lot of, you know, good qualities both in this life and in future lives. There's no, that's not a problem. But they, but whether they actually lead to liberation, that requires the wisdom side of things to kick in. Yeah. Necessary condition. Yeah. Necessary, not condition. Yeah.
Is mindfulness very much part of that path of wisdom in terms of developing wisdom? That's a very basic question. I'm assuming you're referring to the insight part. What would you say is the cornerstone or the basis of trying to develop wisdom if you start off with focusing on building mindfulness?
No.
What was the question again?
How would you start to acquire wisdom? Inquiry.
No. Getting better. No. No experience.
Looking.
Being open.
Introspection.
Well, Tosita, how did you start out learning to be a dentist? Yeah, listening to what the lecturer said, reading the books. Yeah. Did you start out by getting experience? Did the first thing you do, they get in the class, they say to a person, here's a person with something wrong with their teeth, here's the tools, get your experience. It's a bit of that, yeah. But hopefully a bit later on. No. Yeah, yeah, and obviously you need the street smarts, yeah? But hopefully, as far as the industry is concerned, at least, there's a little bit of book smart. So, that's the Eightfold Path, isn't it? First factor is right view. Yeah, it's not right experience, it's not right intention, it's not right knowledge or anything like that. It's not right mindfulness. The first factor is right view. And that's exactly that. That means coming to a Dhamma class, listening, reading the Dhamma books, asking questions, inquiring, discussing. Clarifying view, that's the starting point in developing wisdom.
So where does right view come from?
How do you know it's right?
Because I tell you so. Well, it's a matter of inquiry and so on, but ultimately you know that it's right view, because right view is functionally defined. Everything in Buddhism is functionally defined in terms of cause and effect. What kind of effect does it lead to? So if it leads to establishing better sila, establishing better morality, if it leads to better conduct, if it leads to more happiness, if it leads to development of wisdom and all those kinds of things, then it's right view. Yeah.
But in the same conversation, what can you explain the term intuitive wisdom, intuitive knowledge, intuitive understanding? That particular word attached to those three.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Is it wrong to say that?
To say intuitive?
Yeah, it's like it's coming from what does that mean? I mean, I've heard it flaunted.
What's
so
24 plus 13?
I don't know. Not very good at maths.
37.
That's it. I hope you can't do this.
So where did that come from?
An
But where did the answer come from in your mind?
The brain.
Rational.
Yes, thinking.
Logic.
Or knowledge of addition.
But where did it actually come from?
Someone told you.
So, but that's not telling you where it comes from. Like when you sit there, if you worked out the answer to a question, it appears in your mind, doesn't it? It's just there. Where does it actually come from?
Memory, learning,
synaptic connections.
Yeah?
Yeah,
memory, learning, all those things. But where if you look into your mind, where is it coming from? The reality is you can't see where it comes from. Yeah, it just appears. Yeah. There's no answer. If someone asks you a question, there isn't any answer in your mind. Yeah? Then you do some processes which you've learned are useful for getting these answers, like thinking something through or using mathematical process or whatever. Sometimes you just don't know. Sometimes you try to think. You think about that. Someone, you try to think of something. Yeah. And what are you actually doing when you're trying to think of something? Yeah, but sometimes yes, you use a rational process. You might say, someone might say, you know, what was the last thing you did before you walked into the building today? So you might go step by step back and try to rationally figure out what it was. But most of the time, if you try to say, you know, who was the Chancellor of Germany before the current Chancellor, yeah, I think. Oh, you don't actually know how you're trying to think of something, yeah? But you kind of turn your mind towards it, and then the answer just comes, right? And in terms of how we introspect into our own mind, we cannot see that, ever, no matter what you do. And even if you're in meditation, it's the same. You can be in meditation, and sometimes the answer just comes to something which, you know, maybe you're thinking of before or whatever.
That confidence doesn't come to your mind when you try to think. You know,
exactly, yeah.
And then if I find that if I can't think of the answer, if I'm thinking of something else, often it comes to my mind.
Comes, it can't, exactly. Exactly, yeah.
But not when you're trying.
Yeah, when you're not trying. And often happens in meditation. Someone asked me about that today because they're, you know, someone who's living up in Newcastle or something and he's trying a bit of meditation and his wife's trying to do some meditation and so on, and he's done some Vipassana retreats, and he says that often when he's meditating, you know, suddenly the answer to some problem that he's been having comes to his mind, and he said his wife told him off. She said, no, she said, no, you're not supposed to be thinking about anything, yeah? In your meditation. And so he asked me about it. I said, no, that's what happens, yeah? But the problem is not that the answer comes. The problem is if you get caught up in the answer, yeah? And that you then start to ruminate and reflect and think about it, then that will destroy your meditation. But the answer itself just comes. You go, oh, okay. You just file it away, put it there, and then go on with your meditation, and then afterwards it'll come back. So even when you're meditating, even when your mind is very clear, right? Your mindfulness is at its strongest. Your mind is very still and very clear, and you're watching very closely in your mind, yeah? Still the answers don't come from anywhere. Still they just appear, right? They're just there. Yeah? That's the actual nature of the mind. You don't know where these things come from. They just appear very mysteriously. So to come back to that question of what does intuitive mean, I think all knowledge is intuitive knowledge. Yeah, in that kind of sense, because all knowledge arises, is somehow there and arises in some very mysterious way which we don't have any control over. What you can control, as I suggested before, is you can control in a sense a set of conditions which is useful for the arising of certain kinds of knowledge. Yeah? But you can't actually... How do you actually make that piece of knowledge arise? To me, is very mysterious. So I think what we call intuition and intuitive knowledge is not something which is different in kind from any other very mundane form of knowledge. Yeah? I think it's just... It's just a bit more so. And so what we call intuition is just a bit more so. So that, for example, you can have less data, less information about something. Yeah? But the answer comes. So say somebody who's very intuitive, say in knowing somebody, might just meet somebody and after a few seconds they might get a sense of where they're coming from, where somebody who's less intuitive might take longer to talk to them and get to know them before they'd understand, so that the intuition comes quicker. I think that's all that intuition means.
I've always sort of picked it up as a knowing within you. I can't ever put into clear words to you to myself. That's how I sort of try and reconcile that point.
Mm.
But I can't understand where it's coming from. I just can't.
Exactly, because that's the point, is that that knowing is the essence of the mind itself. So when we're sort of, this is like a kind of meta knowing. It's kind of, you know, you're trying to know the knowing, and you're always kind of running around trying to catch your own tail. Yeah.
Mm.
So this is the problem. Yeah. In the Eightfold Path?
Yeah,
well, they're not. The Brahmaviharas are not formally. You can't formally identify them with any one factor of the Eightfold Path, but they manifest in different ways at different stages. So, most. Obviously, in the stage of right samasankapa, right intention or right motivation, and that's where it actually says avyapada sankapa is the motivation of non ill will, which in a positive sense means loving kindness. So that's where it's actually mentioned there. But that at that stage is samasankapa is basically. Still fairly basic. Yeah, it just means the right thought, the right intention, the right way you're moving or using your mind. Yeah, so it's that loving kindness on a fairly basic intentional level. But then that then manifests in terms of your sila, yeah, speech and action and so on will also manifest those things. And then through the meditation factors, when you're putting into practice right effort, yeah. Part of right effort is to remove thoughts of ill will and hatred and so on, and to develop thoughts of loving kindness. That's right effort. And right mindfulness, of course, is right mindfulness is more specifically maintaining those thoughts, intentions, motivations, feelings, keeping those in mind and maintaining them. So that's what we do, for example, when we're doing the loving kindness meditation, like the guided meditation we did earlier. That's where we're applying metta in terms of that factor of the right mindfulness, satipatthana in the Eightfold Path, is that we're continually bringing that intention to mind. So there's an aspect of samasankapa, is right thought, you know, or right intention, yeah, is still there. We're using that intention of loving kindness, but we're using that now at a deeper level, where it's actually bringing together and integrating the mind in a much more holistic way, yeah? and where the emotion is starting to become more clear, more manifest, so that the actual emotion of metta is becoming manifest and is becoming primary. So that's the development of Brahmaviharas in terms of right mindfulness. And of course, the outcome of that is right samadhi, and so that's the actual perfection of the Brahmaviharas, is when you develop them to the level of jhana, which is what they would have called jeto vimutti, is the heart's liberation.
Why the Buddha recollected his childhood. Jhana, rather than the jhana or practices under his previous teachers, ascetic teachers, and he conveyed the visual idea.
What was his speculative idea? I haven't heard Bhikkhu Bodhi's take on that one.
But he just said it was a bit of query as to why, but I did listen to Matthew said in one of the Western Australian monks, I can't remember which one it was, they might have been Ajahn Brahmali, who's listened to a similar talk, and he thought that because in the sutta it's described under the Buddha's previous teachers, the ascetic teachers, as what is it, the meditation of neither form nor form or formlessness. Yeah, the higher realms, one of the
formless realms.
And Brahmali thought it might have meant what the Buddha meant. It might have just meant a deep meditation. It had a different meaning, just like jhana has a different meaning in Buddhist, pre-Buddhist period. That was his. They didn't actually attain a high meditative level. The Buddha didn't attain that through his teachings. That was his guess.
Let's say once the Buddha was enlightened, he looked for his two previous teachers to teach.
They passed away.
Dust in their eyes.
They must have had some accomplishment.
So why'd he recollect his childhood in particular, and the achievement jhana in his childhood?
Does anyone have the answer?
Did he actually experience jhana as a child?
So
the childhood experience that he actually sitting on a train was how he was busy doing something, and this is what I read, what I understood.
Then again, like to achieve the formless attainment, you have to go through jhana first, right? That's a bit.
So do you think they achieve that level? There's that bit in the scriptures. I don't know. Does that make sense? That non-Buddhists could attain that a high level of meditation.
Yeah, of course, why not?
Yeah, it feels like really essential.
In fact, maybe you're even more enlightened if you're not Buddhist, because, if you're able to spontaneously experience those things without even being taught.
Well, it wasn't necessarily that they weren't taught, they had their own tradition.
But it's quite Buddhist.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where the whole tradition of the Pacheka Buddhas and so on comes in, is the acknowledgement that there are some people who do realise enlightenment and so on without being taught. Yeah, that happens, so that's not a problem. Anyone else have any other theories? I know the answer, but I'm not going to tell you. You got to work for it. You got to work for it.
I don't know what jhana is.
What do you think it is?
I imagine it's something to do with the child being open and innocent, a sort of reflective of the world as a child is. I don't know. But if the idea is that the child has this ability, or Buddha as a child had this, I could think of it as something coming from something that is particular to being a child.
So what would that be in terms of what is...
Openness, a delight, a joy.
Which are all emotional qualities, yeah?
Yes. Emotional qualities, that's right.
Yeah? And I think that's a very telling thing, is that it is an emotional state. And when he experienced that, what comes across is the emotional quality of the moment. He was sitting in the cool shade of the tree while his father was off working, and it's a kind of experience which is it's very easy to imagine that kind of childhood experience, this kind of thing that happens, isn't it? The grown-ups are kind of going off and doing their thing, and the kids, get into their own little world, and they're doing what they're playing or whatever. And So, I mean, obviously, I think we can take it for granted that the Buddha was in some ways an exceptional individual, even at that age. But still, I think it's quite... I think it's probably not that uncommon for people to have some of these kinds of experiences. I don't think it's unique to the Buddha by any means. But it's an emotional thing, yeah? It also comes from an emotional... that sense of contentment, yeah? A sense of simple delight and so on in things. Which is not what happened when he studied under the former teachers. And when he studied under the former teachers, it was quite a different kind of experience. And if you... That whole episode, I think, is invariably... Every explanation I've heard is invariably misinterpreted by not reading the whole text. And what it actually says is that when they first... When the Bodhisattva first went there, He first thing he did was memorize the texts, yeah? Like the dentists. First of all, learn the theory. Yeah? And he said, as far as lip recital went, he could speak with knowledge and assurance. Yeah? So he mastered the oral texts. Now, it doesn't say in the suttas what those oral texts were, but actually, as far as the Pali Canon is concerned, there's only one body of oral literature, which is the Rig Veda. In fact, only one body of spiritual literature at all. There are other religious traditions mentioned very commonly, the Jains and others, but they're never said to have scriptures or oral texts and so on at the time. That they may well have done. Doesn't say that they didn't, but it never talks about it. So when it says that they had mastered the oral text, I think it's a fairly safe assumption that they're talking about Vedic texts or texts in the Vedic tradition, perhaps the Upanishads or something as well. So that's what he masters first, and he says he could speak with knowledge and assurance, and so could others. But then he reflected that that this wasn't the whole, this wasn't all that there was to it, and he said, just as my teacher Alara Kalama has faith, so he mentioned specifically five qualities: faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. Just as my teacher Alara Kalama has these five things, so too I have the five qualities as well. This is what Siddhartha reflected. And and the same for his second teacher, Uddhaka Ramaputta, he also reflected in the same way. Just as Uddhaka Ramaputta has these five qualities, I have these five qualities. So why don't I ask him, where is his spiritual path actually going? And so I asked him, you know, what is the goal of this spiritual path? So when he asked Alara Kalama, he declared the base of nothingness, which of course is one of the very high levels of meditation attainments, formless attainments. So then of course Siddhartha went away, practiced, realized that same attainment, yeah? But after he realized it, he then reflected, this meditation attainment does not lead to an ending of birth, aging and death. It only leads to, in the Pali phrase, yava deva akinchanya yatanam upapajati, is it only leads towards rebirth in the realm of nothingness. And so it specifically is talking about, well, what is the outcome of this spiritual path? That's the issue. So everyone gets caught up on this, whether it's a samadhi attainment or not a samadhi attainment. This is completely missing the point. The point is, what is the point of spiritual practice in the first place? And we know one of the things which is most powerful and most intrinsic to the nature of the Buddha's quest right from the beginning is he's seeking for that which is beyond birth, aging and death. That's the point. That's what he's looking for. That's the essence of the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, and every sutta that's talking about the Buddha's path, he's saying, you know, I've had it up to here with birth, aging, and death, right? I'm out of here, right? Where, what, how can I practice? What can I do that's going to lead to some, to what's beyond birth, aging, and death? And then they teach this thing, and then he was like, well, this is just leading to another kind of birth. Yeah, that's what it says. It leads to rebirth in the realm of nothingness. So obviously that's not what he's looking for. Yeah. And what he reflects is he did not say this samadhi attainment leads to the is unsatisfactory. What he says is this dhamma is unsatisfactory because this dhamma only leads to rebirth in that realm. So of course when he says the dhamma means the religious system as a whole, yeah, which he started with learning the scriptures, which he then developed in the five qualities: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, and then brought to its completion with the realm of nothingness, and that's all. Yeah? And, but that still is caught up within the realm of rebirth. So that's what he rejected. So that's what the story says, and all of those details are directly from the canonical Pali account of that event, and that Pali account is found widely distributed in Buddhist scriptures and is virtually identical in every occurrence. There's no significant variations between the different traditions in that point. So what that shows is a number of things. First of all is that what he was rejecting was the whole system, starting with the theory. Right? Now, presumably, if he was learning a Vedic system, he was learning the Atman theory, right? That's what he would have been learning, surely. Yeah? You know, ancient Indian philosophy, everyone was teaching self this, self that, Atman this, and Brahman that, and so on. He must have been learning some kind of variation on that, and presumably, I think it's very likely it was related in some ways to the early Upanishads, which is in some senses have a very similar sounding teaching. Whether it was exactly what we find today in the Upanishads or not is not certain, but it was probably from a similar cultural environment. Now then he develops faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. Of course these are the five spiritual faculties, right? You all know the five spiritual faculties?
No.
You're bad Buddhists. Go away and learn the five spiritual faculties: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. Very important. So he learned this from his former teachers. Yeah, he explicitly says that these things are things that and this my teacher had these things. And of course, when it says samadhi in there, samadhi always means the four jhanas. And it's not, he can't divorce it from that because it's not an isolated thing. It's the whole package of the five spiritual faculties which are there and which always is defined as the four jhanas. You know, you can't sort of wriggle out of that. And the other point is that it says it leads to rebirth in the realm of nothingness. Well, obviously, you must be having that meditation attainment, otherwise you can't get reborn in that realm. I mean, that's very basic Buddhist theory. So I don't believe at all that you can say that it wasn't the same attainment or anything like that. I don't think there's any justification for that. The only reason people justify it is they say that when it talks about it, it just mentions that attainment. It doesn't mention the whole series of attainments leading up to it. But that's a misreading of the text, because the whole point is that the Bodhisattva is asking, what is the outcome? What's the goal of your spiritual path? So he's not describing everything that leads up to it. He's just describing what is the goal of the spiritual path. So it's perfectly understandable why that's the case. And another problem is in the case of the second teacher, Uddhaka Ramaputta, and there's a little textual nuance in that passage where when the Bodhisattva is referring to his teacher, Uddhaka Ramaputta, and his teacher teaches the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, an even higher meditation attainment. And when he reflects on that, he says, just as Rama, when he reflects on his first teacher, He says, just as Alarika Lama has these qualities, so I have these qualities. Just as Alarika Lama can develop this meditation attainment, so I can develop it, right? When he's with his second teacher, Uddhaka Ramaputta, he says, just as Rama had these attainments, I too can have these attainments and develop them. So it switches the tense from the present tense into the past tense, yeah? And it switches from using his full name, Uddhaka Ramaputta, to using just Rama. Of course, Ramaputta means son of Rama. Yeah? So what it seems to suggest is that actually Uddhaka Ramaputta didn't have this attainment at all. It suggests that he had either a literal father or perhaps a spiritual father who was his teacher who actually had that attainment, but he, Uddhaka Ramaputta, actually didn't have the attainment of neither perception nor non-perception. And that again is why with his first teacher, the first teacher invited Siddhartha to teach the community on an equal level with him, whereas with his second teacher, the second teacher invited him to be the first in the community. He said, you come and teach this community. In other words, that Siddhartha, by attaining this, had actually reached what Uddhaka Ramaputta had not, and which only his teacher had. So again, that suggests that what we're talking about here is something that's actually a very profound meditation attainment. You know, we're talking about, you know, Siddhartha, you know, we're talking about the Bodhisattva here, right? He wasn't going to any kind of second-rate Ningnongs, okay? He wasn't going to the cut price, you know, meditation bargain bins that you could get in. He was going to the very best. Yeah, that's why he sought them out. He was so dedicated and intent. He was going to those teachers who were teaching at the highest level and the most profound meditation attainments. And we know that because they say, firstly, because of that very point that they say that they will invite him to teach their community, right, instead of them. Now, how many spiritual teachers would do that, right? Yeah, say, like, actually, you've got to a further level than I have. I'm getting off the seat. You know, you sit there. You should be teaching. Yeah, immediately tells you that they they were very sincere and that they were actually very, very dedicated spiritual practitioners. We know that, and we also know it from the fact, as was mentioned before, that when the Buddha became enlightened, that was who he first thought to teach, and they have little dust in their eyes. So clearly, there were people that were genuinely of a high level of spiritual attainment. So I don't think there's any reason to doubt that these meditation attainments that they had were genuine and were the same thing. And the difference then comes out. The difference has got nothing to do with the state of meditation as such, in terms of the difference between what the Bodhisattva experienced as a child and what he experienced under his teachers. The difference was that when he experienced it under his teachers, it was all part of a theory. It was all started out with a particular doctrine. Yeah, this is the doctrine, and this is how you meditate in order to realize what this doctrine says. Yeah? That's what the text tells us is going on. And he rejects the system as a whole, the Dhamma as a whole. When he's a kid, it's got nothing to do with doctrine. Right? It's got nothing to do with religion. It's got nothing to do with this little Atman in here is going to become one with the cosmic Brahman or any other kind of doctrine which you might imagine. It's simply the fact that when he was sitting there peacefully, his mind became peaceful, it absorbed within himself, and he had that experience. So by recollecting that, he could actually realize that this experience is actually just a purely natural experience of the mind. This is what happens to the mind in those right conditions. That's what it feels like. It's nothing to do, actually, with that doctrine, yeah, which the Brahmin teachers were trying to attach to it. So to me, this is the crucial difference, and this is the really important thing. Does that make sense?
He saw that way in his childhood as the way out of the round of rebirth.
That's right.
He
yeah.
See something there. So what was it? Why did he feel that method?
Because he's seeing the nature of the mind. Because
right.
when you experience jhanas, what you experience is the mind becoming peaceful. Not because of the intervention of it, or not because of any metaphysical statement, not because of the intervention of a god, not because of it's revealing the existence of this eternal Atman or anything like that, but because it's allowing the real nature of the mind to manifest itself. Yeah? So you're actually seeing how, you know, the defilements are leaving the mind. The mind's becoming more clear, and you realise, oh, actually, that's just how the mind. That's just how the mind is. So this is why it leads to insight.
How would these former teachers have attained such a high level? Would they have had to get rid of the hindrances and the same?
Of course, yeah.
But they would have followed a similar process.
Of course.
The Buddhists would, but they had this preconceived idea of karma.
Yeah, yeah. The real difference between the pre-Buddhist kind of meditation and the real innovation that the Buddha brought in, or one of them is the clarity and the precision with which he described it. And again, in the Buddhist descriptions of meditation, it's described in purely empirical and psychological terms. You know, these certain mental factors are present, other mental factors are absent. Whereas if in the Upanishadic literature, many of the passages in the Upanishads, they sound like meditation-inspired passages, but they're not expressed with anything like the same clarity that you find in the Buddhist texts. And it's only in the later Hindu texts, like the Yoga Sutra and so on, which came later, and which were obviously influenced by Buddhism, that you find that the Brahmanical tradition then adopts the meditation terminology from Buddhism and then integrates it into the Brahmanical system. Yeah.
There is some overlap with the five spiritual faculties.
They still practice that. There are some things like that, five spiritual faculties or the four Brahma Viharas, where the Buddhists will quite happy to say that these were things that were practiced before the Buddha came along, but which actually you can't find in the Brahmanical texts. Okay, so there's no early Upanishads that actually present these things in that way, as that later ones do, yeah. And you can certainly find them in later texts.
So you think it predates Buddhism?
So it's a bit hard to say whether those things exactly predated Buddhism. I think it's very likely that they were around. Whether they're actually formulated in precisely that same way is not clear.
Do you not come to Buddhism with that intention to escape the cycle of rebirth?
Mm.
Let's say, for example, you don't even believe in it.
Uh-huh.
And even if you did believe in it, you don't necessarily care.
Say if you had a friend who didn't believe in it.
Yeah.
That's what we heard today with this Jewish lady was saying that if you go to a rabbi and you ask for advice on something, if the rabbi says you should do X, Y, Z, then that's like it, you have to do it, you can't get out of it. But if you just go for advice and say, it's your friend who has these problems, what should my friend do? Then that's just under advisement, so it's okay. So, anyway, go on, yeah.
Yeah, so let's say that you come to Buddhism with that belief, or rather the lack of that belief,
yeah.
And just a sense of, like, apathy. Like, if I could imagine believing in rebirth, I just can't imagine myself caring what I get reborn as next. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't care.
Why don't you care?
Well, maybe it's because I don't believe in it, so I have trouble having a sort of, I mean, I'm me now, and I don't even know what I'm going to be in the future, and I don't know what I was in the past, so what difference does it make, and, you know.
Sure, yeah.
So, if you come to Buddhism with that sort of view, I mean, what are you doing here, really? Like, is there any point being here?
Oh, there's no question that there's still, you know, many or most aspects of the Buddhist path are still perfectly relevant, yeah. And that's again what the teaching to the Kalamas was, you know, whether or not this is true, it's still.
Still have benefits in this life.
Yeah, yeah. So that's not a question. What is a question is it possible to go all the way? Yeah, can you actually realize enlightenment Yeah, now that's an issue. But, you know, practically speaking, most of us have got, you know, a fair bit of the journey to accomplish before then, before it becomes a pressing issue, yeah? And so as long as... the critical thing is that as long as our view and the way that we see things is sustaining us in a forward direction in our spiritual path, then that's, relatively speaking, right view at that time, yeah? Because it's moving us in that right direction. And we may find, or we may not, we may find that as the path continues, that perhaps we learn to see things in different ways than we did before. Yeah. But that also, I think, certainly in my experience, is a very intuitive thing. We come back to the idea of intuitive knowledge. You know, I was an atheist for many years and never believed in rebirth or anything like that. When I first came to Buddhism, I read Ajahn Buddhadasa, who some of you may know was a very well-known, very kind of skeptical Thai monk, Thai scholar monk. And, you know, and he was... his actual position on rebirth and so on is perhaps more nuanced than... or perhaps not as consistent, but anyway, he certainly was downplaying the idea of rebirth, if not denying it outright. And so when I read his things, I certainly read it as him saying that denying the idea of rebirth, and I thought, okay, well, that's good, so I don't have to change my ideas. And then I found out that most actually other Buddhists did believe in rebirth. I thought they were just silly and superstitious. So, but anyway, I went and did my meditation. And meditation was obviously just valuable in itself, regardless of any kind of belief in rebirth or whatever. But then that just came to me, the acceptance of the idea of rebirth, that just came. Yeah. It wasn't something I consciously did. Yeah.
And then the way I look at it is like each incarnation that we're in, like we're learning lessons of the mistakes we made in the previous one,
right.
So that anything that happens, like to me this lifetime, I'm trying to get it right from last lifetime, and even if I come back again,
yeah.
Like if I learn my lessons,
yeah.
This time round,
yeah.
Like it won't be so mm-hmm. tough next time.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I mean, but
sure,
it's
yeah.
a bit, and it's a bit like, and it is a bit of an intuitive thing with me. I just feel it, like, and
yeah.
I feel it's right, but I can't put it into words.
Yeah.
Like, I can't logically explain it, but
yeah.
I believe it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's
sort of fits in.
There's a degree that, you know, you can use logic and evidence, and you can look at, you know, cases of reincarnation and all of these kinds of things.
Mm.
But then at the end of the day. Yeah, well, you can interpret the evidence in different ways. It's not compelling evidence in that case. It's suggestive. So, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily practically a critical issue for most people, you know, on their spiritual journey. Perhaps until a point of time is reached, and then it does become an issue and it needs to be addressed. So, you know, it can be kind of put on the you know, yeah, just one of those things. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's what the unconscious is largely, yeah. It's got all that kind of wisdom of things from past lives and so on. But definitely, I mean, that's what the whole idea of the Jataka stories and so on is, that, you know, every lifetime you learn something. And, yeah, that's true. We also forget a lot of things and, you know, often you have to repeat the class and learn the same lesson again and again and again until it gradually sinks in. Sure. Yeah.
But do you need to know if that's what's happening? Do you need to be aware of it?
Again, I would say probably at a certain point, yeah.
Because how would you know? I mean, you know, if some person reports to have some knowledge of these things,
uh-huh.
how do you know they're not just deluded or going insane?
Well, you're a psychologist. You should know that there were, you know, seriously, you know, if you to make those kind of assessments, you assess a cluster of different kinds of symptoms and so on, and so you can it's fairly easy to distinguish between somebody who's delusory and somebody who may be mistaken or not mistaken, but you know that's quite a different thing from someone who's just delusory. And there are other kinds of evidence for past lives which are not subject to those kinds of things in the same way. For example, the most persuasive one is the biological physical correlations between marks on people's body and features of people's bodies and events in past lives. And so this again has been, you know, very extensively documented in thousands of cases. So it's not something which, again, I don't think that there's compelling evidence, but I think there's suggestive, certainly strongly suggestive evidence for it. Yeah. But to come back to the question on a more level in terms of what actually happens in meditation, the development of insight. There are two different kinds of knowledge which are developed through Buddhist meditation and which relate to past lives and so on. One of those kinds of knowledge is intrinsic and essential. The other kind of knowledge is not intrinsic. The kind of knowledge which is not intrinsic and which is not essential is ability to recollect your past lives. Okay, so to be able to remember this was my name and this is where I was, this is where I was born and so on. So some people will in their meditation develop that kind of knowledge, and the Buddha did and various others did, but it's quite possible to be an arahant without developing that kind of knowledge. The point of it is that if you do have that kind of knowledge, it gives you more information to work with. You know, you have more, in a sense, you have a greater, well, there's more kind of more things to get disillusioned about, you know, because you're recollecting all of those past lives where you've lived through the patterns, the same kind of patterns, and you can see the outcome of them. So in a sense it gives you more fuel for insight, or greater spectrum of knowledge for your insight to develop. But as I said, it's not essential. The other kind of knowledge of past life is the knowledge through dependent origination. A knowledge of dependent origination is not the knowledge of details of what consists of past life, but it's a knowledge of the principles which is underlying the evolution and development of consciousness. So it's the forces of cause and effect and so on. So the difference being, for example, recollection of past lives might be, from a physics point of view, might be saying, well, if a billiard ball is on a billiard table and it's moving in such a velocity in such a direction, it hits another one, then the other billiard ball is going to go off at such a velocity in such a direction, right? So you can work that out through Newtonian physics, and there's a certain amount of loss from friction and from the impact and sound and so on and so forth. That's recollecting the details of your past life, yeah, as opposed to the understanding of dependent origination, which understands the laws of thermodynamics and says, well, whatever happens on the billiard table, but you know, energy is neither created nor destroyed, and understands the principle that in that system as a whole, energy is going to be conserved, but it can't tell you, well, where is the billiard ball going to hit the cushion? Yeah? So that's the difference. So this is what essentially dependent origination says, is basically that energy is neither created nor destroyed, yeah? And consciousness is a form of energy. It's neither created nor destroyed, it's constantly changing and evolving, but it comes out of something, and it goes into something. Does that make sense? Beatrice is not convinced. I mean, in terms of life, yeah. When you're born, consciousness doesn't just appear out of nothing. Yeah, but there's an ongoing process.
But does it have to come from consciousness, and does it have to transform into consciousness? I mean, you could transform into other forms of energy.
It could, and maybe that's what happens when you realize enlightenment. I'm not quite sure. Yes, that's true. Energy does transform.
I do believe it's one of the laws of thermodynamics that eventually everything would convert to heat, and then, you know.
Which in a sense is true, but I don't know if you know the story of the guys who composed the laws of thermodynamics. There's this whole kind of thing. It's all kind of very kind of rational and so on. But they actually wrote a manifesto and signed it in their own blood, saying that they were going to exclude any metaphysical entities from the description of the universe. Yeah? The fact that you signed this thing in your own blood suggests that there's something not entirely objective about the process. But anyway, yes, that's true. In terms of the law of thermodynamics, if consciousness is an energy, then consciousness can be transformed and it can be from one energy to another. Fine. The reality is, though, in terms of our empirical evidence, is that every moment of consciousness which we actually experience, right, and I'm talking here about inner experience of consciousness, is actually conditioned by another moment of consciousness. That's the inference. We can list a million instances of that every day in every person. So you've got, you could sit there and go, every second, yes, this second was conditioned by the previous second, that second was conditioned by the previous one, and that's the case for 6 billion people. And that's validating that inference millions, billions and billions of times every day all over the world. And there's not one single example, correct me if I'm wrong, where consciousness actually originates, can be shown to originate from something completely else which isn't consciousness, in terms of our own inner experience of it. So to me, that's a very, very strong case to say that actually consciousness is somehow always involved, which is not to say that it can't transform and can't change, obviously it does, but that I think consciousness is part of the structure of things from the very basis. And I think this is also what's implied in, say, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics as well.
So could you be fairly confident where we might end up in our next life? If we achieve a certain level of spiritual attainment, say if I were to be able to get up to the third or fourth gun.
I'll end your home and hose, don't worry about it.
Do you think I can be pretty relaxed then?
Take it easy.
No,
you don't have to have it at time of death. Don't have to worry about it. Yeah. No, you're fine. Brahma realms, here you come. Yeah. Unless you go off and kill your mum or something.
Yeah, right, that would be crazy.
Send your mum back.
You can be fairly, there's a little bit of a sense that you could, from what I can gather,
definitely,
like these former teachers, they were reborn in that realm, the forms realm.
Yeah, as a general rule, any kind of jhana experience is such a powerful event of consciousness that, as a rule, it will overpower any other kind of karma that you commit during your life. And as a rule, you'll get reborn in that realm, unless, of course, you attain full enlightenment beforehand. Or in occasional cases, if there's maybe some other very kind of strong karma which intervenes. But the Buddha gave the simile for that, like the like the sound, the clear sound of a trumpet. And if a trumpeter is blowing the trumpet very clearly and strongly, it'll overcome and be heard above any other sounds that are in the area. So the same way the practice of jhanas, the karma from that will overpower any other kind of karma.
So even those former teachers weren't Buddhists, they attained a pretty high level.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
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 So with the base of nothingness in the realm of perception and non-perception, can people interact there or not?
No, you're out of it.
No.
Yeah. If it's the form jhana realms, you've got a bit more possibility. You've got form, you know, so you can have mouths and ears and things. But in the formless realms, pretty much you never hear any stories of devas from the formless realms or anything like that. Pure abodes you do, but formless realms, that's where the anagamis go. Formless realms, it's like, and they start, right? First formless realm, base of infinite space, starts out with rebirth at 20,000 eons, right? So it's 20,000 big bangs and big crunches, yeah? And then it goes up from there for the other formless realms. So, it's a long term thing. Yeah.
So when they rebirth in the human realm, like the fact that, you know, we're living in Australia, we're comfortably off, really, relatively speaking, we're not in the US at the moment, you know. Is that something to do with our past life in any way? Something we've done or haven't done?
Sorry, do we have a response from...
I'm sorry, I just thought it sort of implied that somehow we'd done something good.
No, I don't know. How does the Buddha look on that?
The basic principle is that what they call the Manusa Dhamma. So Manusa Dhamma is the ten Kusala Kama Pata, 10 pathways of good karma. Essentially the 5 precepts, as well as a mind which doesn't have excessive greed, hatred and delusion, basically is what it is. And that's what's called Manusa Dhamma. So that means the Dhamma which is, or the properties that is appropriate or not appropriate, which is properties that are consonant with the human realm. Okay, so in other words, you get reborn in the human realm because we've developed those properties. Yeah, so human rebirth is always regarded as a fortunate rebirth in Buddhism. Okay, so any human rebirth is by definition a fortunate rebirth. So everybody who gets reborn in the human realm, no matter how unfortunate they may be once they get here, has good karma behind them. Yeah. Of course, that varies. Now, in terms of the things we actually experience in the human realm, some of those things are conditioned by karma, and some of them are not. Some of them are conditioned by the weather, or by genetics, or by the changes in culture around us, or by the conditioning when we grow up, or various other kinds of things. So, if you want to say, you know, are we here born in a good country because we have good karma? Maybe. Yeah, but there's so many factors which are interacting that it's impossible to say in any particular case. So this is why the Buddha said that the workings of karma are unthinkable. Yeah, and if you think about it too much, you go mad. Yeah? So again, if you have these psychic powers and you can actually see a specific connection, yeah, between a specific act that was done in the past and a specific result that's done in the future, in the present, then you can, you can say something a bit more definite about it. But until that's the time, all you can say really is that the human rebirth itself is a fortunate rebirth, And that the things that we experience during our lives are sometimes conditioned by past karma and sometimes not.
What do you think of these people that claim to have these psychic abilities that go around telling other people what they were in their past lives?
What do I think of them?
Yeah.
I don't think very much about them. I don't know, what should I think about them? Maybe, I don't know.
What if some of them are just liars?
Some of them are loonies.
Or loonies. Both.
Well, I'll tell you a story. There's a very good book about that called Hungry Ghosts. So I had it in the Bodhinyana Library, and it was a really excellent one. I haven't read it for years now. I can't remember who the author was, but he was a Canadian journalist, and he was interested in investigating paranormal stuff. And so he didn't have any himself any particular views about it. He wasn't particularly skeptical or particularly believed in it, but he just was interested. So he heard about this. He wanted to investigate mediumship, and he heard about this group where they would meet and channel a kind of entity every week. And so he joined this group and went along with it. Now, the woman who was channeling it was a lab assistant who had no knowledge of the entity that she was channeling. It would just come to her, and she had to ask the other... You know, she had no memory of the time that it happened. She had to ask the people, what was this about? What happened? What did he say? And this group of people would meet every week, and they would see it, and this entity would manifest through this woman, and they would ask questions and have discussions.
The same entity,
The same entity, yeah. It was consistently the same entity.
How did she get the
entity to remember? I can't remember whether she did any kind of ritual or trance or something. I can't remember.
That deeper?
Yeah. And the book was written very, very well. It was very skillfully done because, as time went on, the journalist sort of gradually got more and more invested in what was happening. Yeah? And you know, you can gradually see that even though he started out quite objectively, or feeling that he was doing it quite objectively, more and more was actually emerging this kind of underlying thing that actually, you know, he really was looking for something, yeah, and really wanted to believe, yeah, and that was reflected certainly when I was reading it. You could see that also coming out as well. That like, you know, I was wanting to believe that there was something going on here and so on. But then all these kind of strange things started to happen. For example. He noticed that sometimes people would leave the group and not come back. So he'd go and ask them, you know, what happened. And then he found out, oh, the entity had told somebody else that he was a bad person or something like that. So the entity was kind of playing these political games of dividing people up against each other and so on. And so he began to think, this is a bit weird. Then he decided to investigate another entity. He heard about another group that was channeling another being, so he went along to listen to this, and they're doing these things. Apparently, it's quite common. So he spoke to this second entity, and he said, "Oh, listen, I've been going along and listening to the teachings by your mate, you know, Joe entity over at the other place." And this second entity, Bob entity, he says, "I don't listen to what Joe says. Yeah, he's a charlatan. Yeah." Joe's a complete just stay away from him. So he became very confused. He went back to Joe and said, "Listen, I just spoke to Bob." And Joe says, "Oh my God, stay away from Bob, right?" So he's getting more and more skeptical about this, so he decided, "Okay, I'm going to test you." So he said, "Okay," because this entity had been a human in previous lives, and he said, "I want to test you. What were you in your previous lives, and give me the details, and I'll go and check it out." And so he said, okay. So the entity actually gave him a very extensive set of details and descriptions on two previous lives. And it was very detailed. It wasn't just a sort of a vague thing, but it was a lot of specifics. And one of the immediate preceding life was as a pilot in the Second World War in England. And he gave all the details, the squadron he was in, the planes they were flying, the squadron members, who was in it, what they did, detailed accounts of their wartime activities, where they were based, who they fought against, uh, and all of these kinds of things. And he went back, the journalist travelled to England and checked it out, and every fact checked out. He spoke with the surviving members of the squadron, and every detail checked out. And because he was now getting very sceptical, so he said, well, you know, many of these details would be a matter of public record, and someone would be able to find out by researching who was flying with this squadron or something. But many of the details were actually not a matter of public record at all, and there were many things which were incidental incidents or something involving the pilots or the squadron, which the entity had related to him, which he then talked about with the surviving pilots, and they confirmed it. And they were not, they weren't historical details at all. And so he was, quite convinced by this. He really couldn't see any other way that without involving some kind of paranormal thing. Well, maybe he was reading minds or something, so we can substitute one paranormal thing for another, whatever. So that was that. Then he went to the previous past life before that, which was in Greece, and it was around the corner of Greece, the northeast corner of Greece. I can't remember. What's the border? What's the country that borders Greece on the northeast?
Macedonia.
Yeah, maybe Macedonia, something like that, around that area. And again, he had a whole lot of details, town names, relatives, family, places, everything like that. And nothing checked out. The town wasn't there, the people weren't there, the languages they spoke they weren't even the same languages. Nothing. Yeah. So it was just all completely false. So that was interesting, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's how I relate to these, people who claim that they can, they can recollect past lives and things like that. This may well be the case that some of them might have some genuine abilities, but that doesn't mean that they're going to get everything right, and it doesn't mean that they've always got good motivations. And he concluded that these were genuine entities of some kind, but that they didn't have wholesome motivations, that they were basically feeding off adulation and worship, and they were sort of trying to set themselves up as little kind of gods who were getting worshipped. That's why he called the book Hungry Ghosts, that was actually what they were feeding off. Mm-hmm. There's another interesting case. I could go along with this, but there was another interesting case with one of these early 20th century English psychics. You know how this kind of psychic thing was very popular in England around early 20th century, and there was one of them who was very famous. I can't remember her name now, but there was a very famous and well documented relationship that she had with the head of the Skeptics Society in London at the time, and he really gave her the full treatment and did absolutely everything possible to try to disprove her, and she gave him complete access, and he studied her for years with complete access and complete freedom to test her in any way, and could not refute it, and had no way of showing that she was in any way faking or anything like that, right? And he finished up saying, well, look, I just can't explain it. A number of years later, 10 years, 20 years later, she was caught out cheating, yeah. In a very obvious way, right? Very blatantly, she was cheating. It wasn't, and obviously, if she had been cheating before, he would have found it. No question about that. It was fairly simple what she was doing. So again, the similar kind of thing is, well, maybe she had some kind of power, but maybe she didn't have it all the time. Yeah, maybe it had failed her. Maybe she, her ego or whatever, had got in the way, and her abilities had disappeared. Yeah? So. And you have to resort to other ways to maintain your livelihood. So that's why I think it's always, I'm not inherently sceptical about these things. I do think they are possible, but I do think you need to be very cautious about it.
So one thing that's interesting when people do past life regressions is that they don't describe, or very often, that their past life was an animal or of a deva or something.
So they do or they don't.
Because they usually describe the past life as human.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's something interesting.
It is. Yeah. In Stevenson's research on it, I mean, the teachings on the past life, the picture of past lives which you get from his research, and generally the research is not identical with the picture that you get from Buddhism, and that's one of the differences, is that there's little suggestion of other kind of realms. It seems to be human realm. Another difference is, certainly within Stevenson's thing, is that there doesn't seem to be any particular karmic consequences. Like, people can
birthmarks.
Yeah, there are things that will carry on, but you know, you get people who do like really bad things, who like maybe die in a gang war or something like that, but they still get born in perfectly good human lives. These kinds of things.
Then there's also the time interval question. Like, sometimes they're describing a past life decades before. I'm thinking, like, could they have been in another form during that time?
Right.
So
they've come back to human. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, and my personal feeling on that is that there's probably a bit of both going on. I think in one respect, it's probably true that the details in the way that past lives and rebirth are described in Buddhism are heavily culturally influenced, and that some of those details are not necessarily to be taken too literally. I think that's one thing. But I also think that the reason why people would tend to, if they talk about past lives, would tend to talk about human lives, is because that makes more sense. And that's something which you can actually interpret, meaning consciousness can interpret meaningfully. If I'd been a butterfly in my past life, what kind of memory traces would that leave in my mind? Well, it's probably just more of the random stuff. Yeah, because we've got lots of stuff going on in our minds which we don't actually know, isn't it? Yeah? We can't interpret. So there's probably some of that background of stuff which actually you couldn't really identify. What would it actually feel like to be born as a cat? Yeah. So maybe there are urges which we have which are catly urges, but we couldn't really identify it as such because we couldn't make sense of it.
But then when we hear like, or read descriptions of meditators describing their past lives, that they do go into like animals or you know, deva realms and stuff like that.
Maybe, yeah. In terms of meditators, maybe there's more clarity there. Yeah. So there is that ability to see it in more detail. Having said which, I do think that there are some individuals who do seem to recollect past lives in other kinds of realms. I'm thinking of some spiritual gurus who seem to have basically popped down from the Brahma realm for a brief visit, and who describe you know, just like life as being something which has emerged from light, yeah, and of just having this feeling that they were born from radiance, these kinds of things. And so I think this is what they're the kind of thing that they're talking about. But again, it's not describable in the same way as a human life. Okay.
Can I quickly ask, if you're born with a dog, how do you earn good karma to make you
save your owner's life?
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Be a good dog.
Be a good dog. Is that, how do you sort of make your way back up to the human realm?
Well, it's difficult. Animals make limited karma. Mm. Yeah, they can't. They do. Obviously, they do make karma, but limited karma. They have less choice. Less choice about what to do is good as bad, but yeah. But generally, if you're a kind dog, don't get in too many fights, and yeah, have gratitude for whoever feeds you and stuff.
Okay.